Many people know the story by now, how a 19-year-old Harvard sophomore started Facebook in his college dorm room. Ancient history. That was 2003. Nearly a half billion people now use Mark Zuckerberg's social networking site. Still, Facebook has yet to make a profit, and there are many questions over privacy raised by users and now some governments. David Kirkpatrick is the author of a new book, The Facebook Effect. Good morning.
Good to be here.
Before we get to the privacy issues, I'd like to talk a bit about Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg. You had amazing access to him. What's his worldview, and how does that shape what Facebook is?
Well, he sees the world as increasingly opening up on and off Facebook. And from the day he first created his system, he had this ethos of sharing that he strongly believed in. You know, the history of humanity has basically been in villages and small towns. And in that context, people pretty much knew each other's business. It's very interesting to me that a system created by a guy like Mark Zuckerberg, which is all about sort of getting inside the business of your friends, has emerged just at the moment when we're all moving to cities, because it actually suggests that we can maybe make this transition and retain some of the same dynamic we had in the small town.
And the investment firms are saying that Facebook is worth over $10 billion. What exactly?
More than that, actually. The latest transactions put it in the $25, $26 billion range.
It's extraordinary. So what's so valuable?
Well, in the United States, where about 125 million people use Facebook at least once a month, the average of those Americans, according to Nielsen, is they're spending 7 hours a month there. So you have 125 million Americans spending 7 hours a month, and then you look at it, it's 500 million worldwide. You know, this is just something that you can't disregard. It's a massive, massive way that people are spending their time.
Well, I must say, reading the book, it's very clear that the money part of this almost came as a surprise.
Well, I think if there's a theme to the book, the theme is that Zuckerberg is not building a business. He's building what he considers to be a social movement. And I really do think that's what he thinks. Now, he does think they'll make money over time. It's just that he doesn't make that his priority. The way he's always looked at it is, let's get ubiquity, and once we do, then we'll figure out how to, quote unquote, monetize this thing.
Let's talk about some of the bigger ideas that surround this notion of privacy. Zuckerberg talks about transparency. It's the utmost importance, he says. What he is talking about is you can't have two personas, the professional face and your
right.
personal face. How realistic is that?
Well, that's a really tough question to answer. I mean, he says, and I have a whole chapter, as you may have noticed, which is subtitled, You Have One Identity, which is a quote from him. And he believes that he will live a better life personally, and all of us will be more honest, and ultimately it will be better for the world if we dispense with all of that facade. That's his personal belief. But it's quite interesting that someone holding that belief has succeeded in building a system that 500 million people use.
You do write, though, that 30% of employers have rejected applicants because of things they found on Facebook.
So Facebook or other social networks.
So there's a
yes.
consequence mm-hmm. to having one personality.
Right. Well, I think, frankly, anybody who puts secret data about themselves on Facebook or any place on the internet is naive if they think it's not potentially going to get seen by others.
You have some remarkable examples, which raises questions about personal responsibility. For example, the new head of British intelligence.
I love that example.
After yeah. he was named, it turned out that his wife had been posting pictures of his children and details of his address.
Right.
Prison guards who friend prisoners. In trials, jurors who have posted opinions on Facebook during deliberations.
Right.
You don't have to post that. Do you think that users have something to learn as well?
Well, they definitely do. And you probably also noticed that there's a legal scholar who wrote a long paper last year in which he said he believes a large percentage of what we consider privacy problems on Facebook are what he calls peer-to-peer privacy violations, where our friends, quote unquote, are the ones exposing data about ourselves in ways that we don't like.
One of the themes of your book is the privacy issues are not new, and they've been quite heated with Facebook users over time. Do you think that this is a way that this community, everybody who's on Facebook, is beginning to determine what exactly privacy is?
You mean it's sort of a user-generated decision-making process?
Indeed.
In effect? Yes, we live in an explosive world of data production, and much of that data is about ourselves. And there's not much we can do about it with the extraordinary, you know, marketing apparatus that exists to try to target us both on and off the internet. And we all just act so much digitally. We create data about ourselves at a phenomenal rate. So, you know, I think there's another side to it. There's a certain anonymity in obscurity. As the quantity of data about us grows, the fact that any given piece of data about us might be exposed in the world probably becomes less problematic over time, because similar data is increasingly being exposed about everyone else we know. Therefore, it's less remarkable. And I think whether or not Facebook continues to grow, I think that's going to be the case. And we almost certainly will be less concerned about privacy more and more as time goes on.
Is it possible that it will be governments and not the U.S. government that will push more on this privacy issue?
Well, a number of them have already. You may have noticed just a week or so ago, the Pakistani government was considering shutting down Facebook in Pakistan because there was a group called Everybody Draw Muhammad Day. And that was considered sacrilegious by Muslims in Pakistan. And Facebook actually ended up removing the group, even though technically it wasn't a violation of its terms of service. You know, when you have a genuinely global system like this and all the different value systems that it encounters in being global, I think it's quite amazing all the challenges it's going to face from government. And as I end the book, I say clearly, and I do believe this, there's no way Facebook is going to avoid substantial regulatory pushback in many ways because of the exposure of data, because of the way that it's trying to become an identity sort of infrastructure and maintaining even what might be considered a passport for the internet, when that sort of function has always been done by government in the past.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
David Kirkpatrick is the author of The Facebook Effect, the inside story of the company that is connecting the world. For more information on successful social sites, one example, how one man used Facebook to take on Columbia gorillas, go to our website, npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Deborah Amos.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Many of the cool tools you crave, iPads and smartphones and computers, were dreamed up here in the United States. But when it came time to turn the inventors' ideas into real products, most of the manufacturing work was sent to China. Now, China is pushing for a big change. It wants to become an innovator, too. NPR senior business editor Marilyn Giewax went to China to see for herself how the country is trying to transform into a high-tech leader, and she's in the studio. Welcome back, Marilyn.
Hi, Leanne.
And what were you doing in China?
Well, I traveled with a group of U.S. journalists. We were invited by a nonprofit group called the China-United States Exchange Foundation, and they wanted us to see how China's economy has been evolving. This was my fourth trip to that country, and I have to say, Leanne, I probably used the wrong word when I said evolving, because the place just doesn't so much evolve as it leapfrogs. I'm constantly amazed at the pace of change. And one place with an intense burst of change is Dalian. Dalian's a very beautiful coastal city in northeast China. It's across the Yellow Sea from the Korean Peninsula. And traditionally, it was known for its fishermen and its farmers. But today, Dalian's population is more than 6 million, and it's pretty quickly transformed itself into a prosperous center that has manufacturing, shipbuilding, tourism. And in fact, the government has even created a commodities exchange there, so it's an increasingly important financial center. But the big thing that we wanted to see was that for its next reinvention, Dalian is turning itself into a world-class center of innovation, especially in software.
So how is this new Silicon Valley being built on an old fishing village?
Well, the Chinese leaders, they try to do things by thinking big. About a dozen years ago, they created the Dalian Software Park to serve as an innovation center. And this is a really sprawling campus that mixes academic pursuits with business investments. The park is just huge. It covers several square miles, and it blends classrooms with office buildings that are occupied by hundreds of foreign companies. There's research facilities, apartments, bilingual grade schools, restaurants, recreation facilities. all the ingredients that you'd need to attract the best students, the professors, workers, all kinds of deep thinkers from around China and really from all over the world. A lot of these buildings are already up and running. Some are under construction. Others are in the planning stages. But, you know, whether you, when you throw all these things together, all these people are thrown into the soup together, does it really cook up fresh ideas? Well, you know, it's a recipe that's worked for the United States. You look at Stanford University, which has a beautiful campus in California, and they put together a lot of bright students, entrepreneurs, and it spun off the Silicon Valley. And we've seen the same kind of thing at MIT in the Boston area or the University of Texas in Austin. These are all places that became clusters of innovation. So it's really possible that this Dalian Software Park, with all of its classrooms and its entrepreneurs, that they really could come together to become a hotbed of new ideas.
But how confident are the Chinese that they can generate their own intellectual property?
They're very optimistic. They think they have a lot of potential to add real value to the high-tech world. They want their own brands of computers and software, and they want their people to be the ones who have the patents, not just doing the low-end work in a factory as an hourly worker.
So, Marilyn, if Dalian does spin off lots of new ideas, does that mean a relative decline for Silicon Valley?
Not necessarily. If you believe in capitalism, then you believe that competition is a good thing. And competition from China could really help the United States by pushing our innovators to work harder to develop new products and come up with more efficient ways to do things. And just as one example, the Chinese are particularly determined to come up with ideas for clean energy. If they were successful, potentially that could help the whole planet.
Marilyn, what was your sense about how much of what you saw and what you heard was actually true and how much might be propaganda?
Well, I don't know if you'd call it propaganda, but there may be some wishful thinking. You can't necessarily just throw everybody together and automatically produce the results you want. That still has to be proven. So I don't think that they're giving us propaganda, but maybe it's a little bit optimistic beyond what the evidence shows so far.
So sugarcoating.
Maybe a little bit. But, you know, it's an impressive facility, and it could very well come together.
NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Geewax, thanks and welcome back.
Oh, you're welcome, Leanne.
AT&T has apologized for a security breach that exposed the email addresses of 114,000 owners of 3G Apple iPads. Those affected are early iPad adopters and powerful ones, including New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, ABC's Diane Sawyer, military personnel, business executives, and on and on. The iPad breach was committed by a hacker group called Goatsy Security, which says it aims to expose security vulnerabilities. That group in turn contacted Ryan Tate with the website Gawker, which then broke the story. And Ryan Tate, how did the hackers do it?
The hackers were able to access a script wide open on AT&T's web servers that allowed them to submit some IDs and get back some email addresses of some very powerful people.
And once they got those email addresses, what would that allow them to do?
At the very least, they'd be able to spam and try to trick AT&T users. There's also been some talk that the network ID information they obtained could be used to potentially hijack, impersonate, or eavesdrop on data connections. There's disagreement among experts on this issue, but there are several who say that it is possible if you are sophisticated enough. Hmm. And given that some of the targets include high-ranking officials in the military and government, it's not inconceivable that someone would go to extreme measures to try and intercept some of this traffic. Hopefully none of these devices are actually being used to trade confidential information.
And just to be clear, though, the Goatsy, this group that tries to expose vulnerabilities, when it did this, they got the email addresses. They didn't get actual access to what's inside those email accounts, right?
That's right. If you have an iPad, the information in the iPad, the emails, the pictures, all of that information should be safe. They do have your email addresses. Maybe they can spam you. The broader question is whether AT&T has other security holes like this that have gone undiscovered or unreported. So it may give some consumers pause, but for now, people who do have these devices should know that the information inside them is protected.
Well, I've been reading conflicting views from folks about how worrisome this security breach is. What do you think?
I think it's more worrisome for what it says about how AT&T is handling data. I don't think information exposed in this particular breach is hugely harmful in and of itself. It's more harmful for what it signals about how AT&T is treating this data, and it's also harmful in piercing some of the image Apple has created for itself as a company that can really protect people from the scams and privacy breaches that people encounter on the internet.
And also another complaint, I guess, to add to the list from users, AT&T is the exclusive wireless service provider for the iPad and the iPhone, and there are a lot of complaints about the quality of that service.
Yeah, there were complaints even before this breach about AT&T's inability to provide reliable internet access on mobile devices like the iPhone and the iPad. So this just raises the question of whether Apple will finally ditch AT&T for a different provider, or at least expand the choices for users to companies like maybe Verizon or Sprint or all the other mobile carriers out there. This just gives Apple one more reason to try and find another partner.
Okay, Ryan Tate with the website Gawker. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Ryan Tate with Gawker broke the story about the iPad data breach.
This is NPR.
The writer Clay Shirky has been monitoring the free time we have in our lives, and over the past several decades, he says, we've spent a lot of that time doing just one thing.
Television became essentially an unpaid half-time job for every man, woman, and child in the developed world, right? 25 hours a week or so, times a couple billion people.
New research shows the internet is eating up more and more of our TV watching time.
Clay Shirky writes about this sea change in his new book, Cognitive Surplus.
A cognitive surplus is my phrase for the cumulative time and talents of the networked world, because we're all networked together. We can share things. We can take on projects larger than what one person can do in their basement. And so the cognitive surplus is the reason we have, you know, billions of photos on Flickr and 24 hours a day of video being uploaded every minute on YouTube. It's the reason we have Wikipedia and open source software. The amount of time and talent we have to swing to shared problems and civic action is incredibly vast.
But there's also a lot of cute kitty sites on the web.
The internet is fueled by cute cats, yeah.
And in fact, I can waste just as much time looking at cute kitty sites as I ever could watching sitcoms. So what's the balance?
Right. But the interesting thing about lolcats, about these cute cats made cuter with the application of cute captions, is that when you see a lolcat, you get a second message, which is you could play this game too. Right? When you see something on television, the message is, you could not do this. You can only consume this. There is a giant gulf between doing something and doing nothing. And someone who makes a lolcat and uploads it, even if only to crack their friends up, has already crossed that chasm to doing something. That's the sea change. And you can see it even with the cute cats.
And I see it in a very nice anecdote that you have in your book about a little girl who's watching a video. Mm. And she gets up off the couch and she goes to the back of the TV. Yeah. And her father thinks, oh, she wants to see the characters and see where they are. But what she's looking for is the mouse. It's inconceivable to this four-year-old that you can have television that you can't interact with.
I mean, you see this with kids. I see this with my kids all the time. They'll see a screen out in public and they go up and they touch it because they assume that it's going to respond to them. People who are used to those opportunities will both look for them when they're young, but I'm also imagining will design around them when they're older. When they come to start making media, they're going to start assuming that other people will have some kind of input as well.
There's always a list of losses that accompanies
yes.
any new technology, and there is a cottage industry of hand-wringers.
More than a cottage industry, let me tell you.
And let me give yeah. them their voice. One is vanishing attention span. Deep right. reading is right. gone. Social right. polarization.
Right. The social polarization one is, in my mind, the most interesting. Cass Sunstein kicked this off with Republic.com and the worry about the echo chamber. What's so interesting now, though, about the echo chamber is that the political movement in the United States that is in a way most consistently creating an environment where the opinions are internally consistent and resistant to dialogue is the Tea Party. And yet the Tea Party is characterized by the people who grew up in the old media landscape. The Tea Party is one of the few protest movements in the U.S. not driven by teenagers and people in their early 20s.
But I am told that they wouldn't exist without an internet way.
Oh, no, of course.
To meet up.
Everybody uses the internet all the time. Even the hand-wringers use the internet. The interesting thing to me about the echo chamber argument is that it actually seems to have been a description not of the internet, but rather of the world of three television stations and one local newspaper, which is to say the media landscape of the 20th century, with its incredible paucity of sources, created more of an echo chamber than what we're seeing today.
You document some important social networks. There's one in Kenya that mapped information like election violence, and it actually helped people stay away from places that they could get hurt. There's a website called Patients Like Me where people share their symptoms and actually improve care for patients. When you look on balance at this evolving landscape, do you see more patients like me than lolcats in a way that you can tell which way it's going?
Well, I don't believe there's a which way question. We don't actually have to choose. We can have both lolcats of the cute cats, and we can have patients like me. Let me bring out Harvey Suedos, who's an American novelist, and I quote him in the book, who said in the middle of last century, you know, are paperback books going to flood the market with trash, or are they going to mean that we have access to the classics? And the answer to that question, of course, was why pick? Right? The abundance of paperback books meant we could have all of both. So I don't think there's a trade-off between how many lolcats and how many patients like me sites are there. I think the trade-off is how well are we going to support things like patients like me, which are trying to transform medical research culture. So the thing we need to be concentrating on is finding the people who are going after creating civic value and helping them, regardless of the entertainment value of the cute cats.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Clay Shirky teaches at the Interactive Telecommunications Program at New York University. His new book is called Cognitive Surplus.
Well, of course, we reached out to Facebook and Twitter to find out what you had to say about your cognitive surplus.
One comment came from Greg Coulter. When I write anything or take pictures or make movies, it's almost with the intent of posting it on the internet.
Kathy Swink writes that the internet has inspired her to get more creative in the kitchen.
She says TV cooking shows are too slow for her taste, and they don't offer tips and tweaks from others.
Pete Mortensen says the internet has made him more, quote, fake productive. You can communicate with our incredibly productive staff at Morning Edition's Facebook page or on Twitter at Morning Edition or at NPR Inskeep. Our program is directed by Van Williamson and Lindsay Totti. The production staff includes Claudette Heberman, Steve Monroe, Vince Pearson, Leah Scarpelli, Selena Simmons-Duffin, Joanna Stein, Travis Larchuk, and Chris Benderev, with Ben Bergman and Melissa Yeager-Miller at NPR West. Our executive producer is Madalika Sika.
The executive director of news programming is Ellen McDonnell. Morning Edition's theme music was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. I'm Deborah Amos, in for Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. This past week, Apple CEO Steve Jobs unveiled the latest iPhone. It's an event that's become the tech world's equivalent of the Oscars. The story of Apple's founding is the stuff of legend in the Silicon Valley. Two young programmers, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, created that company out of nothing. But there was a third founder. His name is Ron Wayne. And on April Fool's Day, 1976, he got together with Jobs and Wozniak to write Apple's incorporation document. 12 days later, Wayne left Apple and a stake in the company that today would be worth billions. He now lives in a modest home outside Las Vegas. And when I spoke with Ron Wayne a few days ago, he recounted the beginnings of Apple Computer.
Jobs and I had known each other. We'd worked together at Atari. He was a contract engineer for Atari. I was the chief draftsman and product development manager.
Atari, which primarily made computers, PCs, and video games, right?
At that time, it was strictly street coin-operated video games. Mm. And Jobs and I were fairly chummy. We had lunch together, had dinner together, had interesting conversations about all sorts of subjects and so on.
And I understand he was considerably younger than you. You were sort of a veteran at the time, and he was like a kid, right?
Essentially, that's correct. I was in my early 40s, and he was in his early 20s, along with Wozniak. The two of them were involved in a computer club with people who were essentially tearing business computers apart and putting the bits and pieces together to make up some sort of a personal computer, since no personal computers existed at that time. And Woz eventually came up with a basic circuit that laid the foundations for the personal computer. The two of them finally decided that maybe it might be a good idea to go into a business manufacturing personal computers. Everything went along just fine at the beginning until Jobs and Wozniak came across a mild dispute. And it had to do with the rather whimsical nature of Mr. Wozniak. And he wanted the latitude to use that circuitry in other places besides the Apple computer.
But, of course, Steve Jobs was saying, wait a minute, we've developed this together for this company that we kind of want to start. This is proprietary.
You've got it.
That's and so that's exactly where right. That's where you came in.
That's where I came in because Steve Jobs was not exactly able to persuade Wozniak that that's really what the situation was, and he thought that maybe I could do a better job. So I invited them to my home, and I was able to finally get Wozniak to understand the proprietary nature of such circuitry and how important it was that it be the property of Apple. And as it turned out, Jobs was rather impressed with my ability to play diplomat with Wozniak and suggested that they would form a company based on 45% for himself, 45% for Wozniak, and 10% for me as a tiebreaker.
And so you began to draft an agreement, right? A company statement that became Apple Computer, right?
Essentially, I had had some background in writing and legalese, so I actually drew up the original three-page contract and put in all the details and understandings that had been agreed to by everyone. And three copies were run. We signed them all off, and then they went down to the Santa Clara County Registrar's Office and filed it as a company.
12 days later, you decided to leave the company. Why?
One of the things you have to understand is that a few years before, I had had my own corporation in Las Vegas. I used to design and build slot machines. I don't think I was in business too long before I realized I really had no business being in business.
The business collapsed? Or?
Yeah, I was a much better engineer than I was a businessman.
You lost a lot of money?
Oh, boy. The whole thing folded up. I went back to California literally with $600 in borrowed money and then spent the next year and a half making sure that all the creditors were paid off 100 cents on the dollar, and I bought back every share of stock that people had bought.
And it was a
very traumatic experience.
Traumatic, so you obviously were not interested in taking that kind of risk again.
You have it exactly.
But what kind of risk did you...
This is something I must clarify. I had no doubt whatsoever that Apple was going to be a very, very successful enterprise. What I was concerned with was that the beginnings of the company were going to be quite a roller coaster. And at my age and the experience and background that I had made me feel that I really wasn't up to going through that kind of an exercise.
So I
simply went down to the registrar's office, pulled myself off the agreement. There was no animosity either between Jobs or Wozniak or myself. It was simply a matter of a decision I made based upon the circumstances.
But why did you do that? I mean, simply by being part of the company, were you worried that it opened you up to liability or...
Absolutely, it did. Mm-hmm. For a start, Jobs had gone out and in a very businesslike way, had sold some personal computers to a retail outlet by the name of the Byte Shop. And two things immediately popped up. One, I heard that the Byte Shop had a terrible reputation for not paying their bills. And second, very appropriately, Jobs had gone out and borrowed $15,000 to get the materials necessary to fill that order. Hmm. But this was a company, not a corporation, which meant that I was immediately liable for 10% of that $15,000. And if the thing blew up, I had no idea where I was going to come up with $1,500 in order to cover my end of the obligation. To be very simply, to focus it down, I thought that if I stayed with Apple, I was going to probably wind up the richest man in the cemetery. So I figured I'd better go off and do other things.
Yeah, you would probably have a heart attack.
So... Yeah. That was basically it. I was just not prepared for that kind of adventure.
No one ever offered you a job or said, hey, you know, we'd like to bring you back into the company?
Well, twice since I separated myself from the company, Jobs offered me a position at Apple. And on both occasions, I declined.
Why?
Because I like to take things from beginning to end, where I can wear six or seven hats. I couldn't do that at Apple. I was going to be in one niche or another, and that wasn't my style of working.
Apple, as you know, has just been named the world's most valuable tech company, surpassing Microsoft, worth something like $222 billion. You've heard this before. I'm sure you've thought of this many times. Your 10% share would be worth billions of dollars today. Do you ever ask yourself, what if?
To what purpose? I mean, whatever has been, has been. I learned a long time ago not to what if these things. It means nothing. All you can do about yesterday is to learn from it. Would I have been better off if I had stayed with them? Probably. But at what cost? I don't know.
Ron Wayne, what are you doing now? What do you do for a living?
I'm retired. I live on my Social Security, and I supplement my income by casually dealing in collector's stamps and coins. I've also done a few little engineering projects on the side, and I've written a book, matter of fact, two books, which I hope someday to be able to publish. And maybe I can do something out of that. But I am not in uncomfortable situations. Let me put it that way.
Is it fair to say that you did not become a rich man?
I did not become a rich man. I've never been rich, but I've never been hungry either.
That's Ron Wayne. He was one of the founders of Apple Computer back in 1976. If he'd stayed, his share would have been worth about $22 billion today. We spoke with him from his home in Pahrump, Nevada. That's about 60 miles west of Las Vegas. Ron Wayne, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Twitter isn't just a medium for exchanging URLs and shopping tips or telling your friends what you had for lunch. As our linguist Jeff Nunberg observes, it's also given rise to an outpouring of haiku.
Sun Microsystems' Jonathan Schwartz was a thoroughly modern CEO, the first to have a blog. So when he resigned recently, after the company was acquired by Oracle, he didn't simply tweet the news. He put it in the form of a haiku. Financial crisis, stall too many customers, CEO no more. Schwartz had both thumbs on the pulse of the medium. Haiku are like amaryllis. They thrive in close quarters. And with its 140-character limit, Twitter is blooming with haiku, or twaiku as some call them. There are Twitter feeds for NASCAR haiku, cat haiku, zombie haiku, and user interface haiku. There are haiku competitions and campaigns. Jimmy Kimmel offered tickets to his show to whoever tweeted in the best haiku about the final episode of Lost. The British Rail Company asked passengers to tweet their haiku on the theme of the London summer, a topic that's nicely suited to a poem of three short lines. And after Glenn Beck said recently that churches were using the phrase social justice as a code for Nazism and communism, the organization Jewish Funds for Justice urged supporters to flood Beck's Twitter account with haikus of protest. Sarah Silverman offered this response: churches and their code, it's like when they say bless you, and yet no one sneezed. Of course, people were writing haiku in English long before Twitter came on the scene. In 1914, Ezra Pound made the haiku the model for his famous 14-word poem, In a Station of the Metro. The apparition of these faces in the crowd, petals on a wet black bough. Ever since then, serious poets have been trying to adapt the features of the haiku to English, its economy, its chiseled syntax, and its juxtapositions of images. But not many have paid attention to the idea that a haiku should have exactly 17 syllables. In fact, Japanese haiku can have fewer than that, depending on the length of the vowels. But the haiku on Twitter don't often reveal a debt to Pound or Kerouac or Robert Hass, much less to Basho. For most people, the appeal of the haiku is precisely that it isn't weighted by tradition, so that you can take it wherever you like. Most are humorous and satirical, but they can also be lyrical, wistful, or serene. In the paint-by-numbers version of the form that most of us learned, there's really only one absolute constraint, that very rule of 17 that poets tend to disregard. That's what makes haiku so easy to write. You don't have to worry about rhyme or alliteration or meter. You can put the stresses and breaks anywhere, as long as the syllable count comes in on target. First you tick off 5, then 7, and then 5 more. Hey, there goes one now. It's only when you look at the outpouring of haiku on Twitter that you realize how pervasive they've become. They've completely filled the cultural space that was once occupied by light verse. Not that you can't find people posting that on Twitter, too. If you make strategic use of abbreviations, you can get a limerick down to exactly 140 characters, what people call a perfect touche. But compared to the flood of haiku, the light verse is just a trickle. It's a specialized taste these days. It survives in the crannies of culture alongside of charades and jigsaw puzzles. It's become a kind of fusty shtick. It conjures up the voices of Carl Castle and Charles Osgood. There are still skillful practitioners like Calvin Trillin in the nation. But to judge from the verse that shows up on websites and Twitter, most people don't have the hang of writing it, not even the poets and professors. But that was inevitable once we lost our feel for the traditional rhythms that light verse has always drawn on. There was a young lady from Spain, ta-tum-ta-da-tum-ta-da-tum. The anapestic cadences of the limerick are the same ones children used to learn from reciting Browning, Scott, and Tennyson. Oh, well for the fisherman's boy that he shouts with his sister at play. But children aren't steeped in those poems anymore. The only anapestic poems that everyone still knows are The Night Before Christmas and Horton Hatches the Egg. Well, those and The Star-Spangled Banner. I feel very wistful about this. I grew up listening to my dad read the poems of Peter DeVries, E.B. White, and Phyllis McGinley that appeared in The New Yorker every week, before the editors decided that light verse was beneath the magazine's dignity. But that eclipse was first set in motion long ago, when poetry and verse went their separate ways with the advent of modernism. Actually, at just about the time Pound was discovering the haiku. And if the reams of haiku on Twitter aren't exactly verse, they're still poetry, people making their thoughts conform to a fixed formal pattern. And every now and then, you run into a haiku where someone's come up with an ingenious or surprising way to work that union of meaning and form. Just like light verse, that is, the haiku gives you a chance to be clever. That's a dismissive word to use for a serious poem, but it's the highest tribute you can pay to a playful one.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. You can find links to every Twitter feed Jeff mentioned on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also add your own haiku to the comment section of our website.